Session number 10123.
Mr. Watney, Reel 3, you were saying that the Germans knew about these suitcases.
And so, well, the best thing was not to walk around from one place to another with one of those suitcases in your possession. And so I did radio the War Office so that I had about 7 or 8 other radios dropped to me, and I did carry those around to odd hideouts in the county and leave them in those places so that if I had to leave one place, I could hide the radio and go without another radio to another place where I could just pick up another radio. So I was never travelling with a radio in my possession.
I think you were telling me earlier about the problems you had when you first landed.
Well, when I first landed, of course, unfortunately, they dropped George and I, but the only thing they hadn't dropped was my radio set. So it was impossible to be in contact with the War Office. So I did, a friend of mine found a radio transmitter which had been Polish, and the Pole had been taken, and he got me this Polish radio, and I connected it up and managed to get hold of the War Office and said, could they please drop me some radio sets? And so they dropped me about 7 and 7 or 8, and I left them around the county in kind of hideout places, you know.
You were also telling me earlier a story about immediately after you were dropped, you were stopped by the police.
Oh, yes. Well, when we came, immediately after dropping, we were being driven back by Jean Verlac to his farm. Farm and cheese. He made cheese. And as we were going along, Harry Pullivy said that we mustn't bury our parachutes, which we were taught to do. We must sit on them in the car because they could be used very easily for underclothes for girls in the resistance.
Because they were silk.
They were kind of, because they were pure silk, and so they were, in a way, bribes to our people in the resistance with us. I don't know now.
And you said you were then stopped by the police.
Oh, then, yes, then there were about 3 police people with torches, and they stopped the car, and they came along. They wanted to know who we were, and then they said, oh, you've just collected the English. So he said, yes, yes, well, let's see them. And they shone their torches on George Hiller. They said, he's not English, he's French. Then they turned the torch on to me, and they said, oh, no, he's English, all right. And then, but they wanted to stop us, but Jean Verlac said, but well, where did you get your cheese from? In your headquarters. And he said, but you get it from us. You get it from Verlac's. We always give you the cheese free of duty. You don't have to give your ration cards for our cheese. He said, if you stop us any longer, he said, you're not going to have any more. We have to stop your cheese. So they let us go on. And that was, that gave me a bit of a shock to start with. But I was surprised that they said, oh, yes, well, they're English. Oh, all right, then you can go on.
Did you learn much about the attitudes of the French people under the occupation, what their attitudes were towards the Germans and towards the British?
The feeling was that they disliked the Germans intensely as the whole lot. They found that the Germans were rather they had to do mostly with the Gestapo people and with the agents around, and of course then there were some French groups who formed under the Vichy government and as associated with the Germans, and they were groups called the Milice and the GMR, and they joined in and they did work for the Germans. They worked for the Germans, and of course they naturally, French people working for the Germans were worse people to get away from than real Germans.
Was that? Did you come across much anti-British feeling?
No, just the opposite. Very pro-British. Very pro-British because they said that the feeling was that that area of France had for very, very many years been the residential home of the kings of England. It had at a time belonged to Britain, and a lot of them are in some way descended from the British. Now, they were completely different from the people in the industrial north of France, where the British are considered as having taken the business away from the French, doing business through the States, and it's like that, easier than the French and getting there before the French. So the northern industrial area of France is not so pro-British. They like the British, but they, as competitors, they dislike them because they're competitors in business. But down in the south, southwest of France, they're considered as really the same lot.
Did you have any
other... people like Hennessy Brandy. Of course, he was a British Army, but he was in the British Army in the Cognac area of France, and he decided after a short while there that he was going to resign from the British Army and buy a farm and start making brandy. And so they're still there, the Hennessys are still there. There are a lot of British people still living in that area. A lot of them.
Coming on to the Allied invasion of Normandy, can you tell me how your own work was affected by that?
Well, we knew about this because they gave me they let me know on the radio. Yes. Well, when they informed me that they had three messages which they would read on the BBC news, after the BBC news, there were three messages which indicated that there would be a landing in Normandy the next day. And we had our, what was a resistance group, had become into Mackies and were partially soldiers. And we had them organized. We'd got communications going between all our groups. We had roughly 7,000 men under our command. And when the landings took place, there was, at that time, in Montauban, the German SS Panzer Division, Das Reich, which was, I think, the most powerful regiment in the German army, with their tanks. And we had got to try and prevent this division reaching the landing grounds. So immediately after the landing, we then put troops all along the main roads at kind of hiding places along the main roads up to the north, up to the Normandy area. And we as the Germans started off very much with their tanks loaded on lorries, we used bazookas and anti-tank guns that we could get hold of. We used explosives, and we tried to. We didn't shoot the first lorry. We used to let the first lorry go by, and then one would then shoot on the second lot. And then, of course, the whole thing would stop, and the men would jump off with their guns and machine guns, shooting. But you, of course, had got your hiding place, and it was normally off the road, and you could run back to a lorry and get onto the lorry and drive further up and stop on the side of the same road going north, but it's another place a bit further north. And then you'd set up all your booby traps and things there, and when they went up, you could attack them again in the same way. Now, there were probably about 12 people in one group, but as I said, that we were 7,000, my lot. By the time they got to Suyak, in the northern part of the lot, there were over 200 lorries with their tanks were off the road completely. And one of our colonels went down in civvies to check up on the tanks that were in Suyak going north. And I radioed the information through to the War Office that time.
I think you were telling me earlier that you came across André Malraux about this time.
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me how that came about?
Well, André Malraux was sent to France. Well, no, he was in France, but he was considered by de Gaulle to be the head of the French resistance in France. And he came to us. He came to us, and we were at that time just going to send down a car to see the troops in the town, that's a department further south, to plan about the invasion tactics. And George Hiller and André Malraux and Colonel Collignon and the driver went off in the car. I was in a Mackie, about 7 kilometres from Gramma, that night, and on their return at 5 o'clock next morning, we couldn't warn them that a German armoured division had put their headquarters in Gramma. And of course, when they were driving through Gramma, a sentry saw them, shot at them, killed the driver of the car, which somersaulted and overturned on the edge of the road. Out of the car got André Malraux, and he received bullets in two legs, in his two legs, and he fell to the ground. George Hiller got out next, and he had a Sten gun, and he dropped his Sten gun on the road, and as he bent to pick it up, the Germans shot him in the stomach with a dum-dum rifle. Then Colonel Collignon managed to get off while they were watching Malraux and George Hiller, and he escaped into a wood. And the Germans then took André Malraux off for questioning. George Hiller, they thought, was they left him, they thought he was dying or dead, and they saw that Carignan had got into a little small wood, and they put a sentry on either side of the wood to prevent his escape. And he waited because he knew that sometime the sentries would want to get together, to just have a word together. And he waited, and when they did get together, he shot them both. And then he walked and ran the 7 kilometers to the Mackie where I was. And he arrived and he told me that George Hiller was smashed up. So I had at the time, I was lucky enough to have a Bugatti car one of the lake made Bugatti cars, a coupe, and I got into it with on the roof a Bren gun, and we drove to Grammar, just outside Grammar, on the sign where it says the post where it says Grammar, I saw George Hiller on the floor, and so I stopped. Well, we stopped the car, and I ran out and picked him up with my friend, and we carried him back to the car, drove the car to a village that we knew was uninhabited, where we put him into the church, the church minister's house, and which was empty because the whole village was empty at that time. And then we I had to get on radio to London to try and get supplies of anti-gangrene tablets and, you know, all the required things for an operation. And I wanted those dropped immediately. And I then we had to go and try and get a surgeon. And we did go and get a surgeon who had resistance feelings. And we got him and brought him out there, where then we had to operate on George Hiller, and as having no kind of gas or any type of injection to give him to release the pain, I held his chest and shoulders on the table, and two other resistance people held his legs, while Georges Lachaise and the other doctor were trying to clean out the... He had two handkerchiefs in his tie, among other things, all stuffed into the hole that was brought out of his stomach by the dum-dum bullet. And, of course, they had all coagulated and got stuck in with the blood, and all that had to be taken out and cleaned, and particularly disagreeable thing to hold your friend while this was going on. As he was being, the wound was being cleaned, I could see something which upset me, and it is that he had got his bottom lip between his teeth, and with the pain, and he'd bitten right through his bottom lips, and his teeth were joining through the bottom part of his chin. After about an hour and a half, they considered that the operation was satisfactorily completed, and we got a bed there and a nurse and guards, and we left him in that house.
Was he got back to England?
Yes, about a month after that, when he, as Dr. Lachaise, stayed with him all the time, and he was certainly feeling much better after a month. She was getting very much better. And they sent a plane, and we loaded him into the plane so that he could be flown back to Britain. He was... he certainly got over the operation very rapidly, because when I got back, about 2 or 3 months afterwards, he was already walking around and would meet me walking with a walking stick.
Did you see much of André Malraux?
Saw quite a lot of him. But he was planning on a much higher level of the new de Gaulle government of France. Of course, he was a very difficult person to have an argument with, because he was so... extremely intelligent, but as a person who had been in the Russian Revolution, had known Trotsky and those people, he then followed that by going out to China and taking part in the Chinese Revolution. He then came back to Europe, and when the battles started in Spain between Franco and the Spanish government. The Spanish government at that time was a communist government, and Franco was, of course, fascist. And he went over to and joined the government, the communist government, and served as a squadron leader in their air force.
Why did you have these arguments with him?
Arguments with him because, of course, I was there, I was acting for the socialists, but he was a very communist mind, and I was very anti them talking about the politics of France after the war was over. I was more interested in fighting the war first and talking about the politics afterwards. And that he did agree with me in that it was first, it was more important to get the war won before we talked about politics in the country.
Can you remember anything specific he said?
No, I've got his book here with the arguments.
Under what circumstances would you normally meet him, though?
Well, we weren't living in chateaus and things. We were living in a mackie, which was rather a derelict house or hut, and we would have maybe a table there where we used to sit on a bench and talk round a table. And he was accepted. He was very often in a car going off to see some other resistance group or coming back. But he did make, at that time, his headquarters were in our group.
Was he a likable man or not?
Oh, very much. Very likable person. Very likable person. Charming. He had a tics. Little ticks where he was always scratching his nose and things like that, but it was amusing ticks. But he was really a very charming man, but he had a very great writer, and I mean, to have been made Ministre des Beaux-Arts after when de Gaulle took over, from a political point of view, he was more anarchist than communist. He was very much in any kind of political warfare in the world. He was more for the communists.
What was his appearance at that time?
Well, he was fairly... Whereas I was very young at the time, so people seemed to be much older. I would say he was roughly 45 or so. He was well built, and he was very—he was had plenty to say.
What was? What did he seem to be? A brave chap?
Brave.
A brave man.
Oh, good heavens, yes. I don't think he didn't know what fear was. He certainly didn't. I mean, he wouldn't have gone out of his way to be in the Russian Revolution, the Chinese, or then in the Spanish, which were nothing to do with him, really. He was a volunteer in those. But he was a great man, really.
You were telling me earlier about the communists taking over Toulouse. I wonder if you can tell me that story again, how you were involved with that?
Well, that was... After the landings in Normandy, we naturally wanted to try and take certain of the areas of the southwest of France, because the Germans would be moving troops up to reinforce against the landings. We went down, Ravanel, who was the head of the communist in southwest France, came to me, and he, we decided our plans for the attack on Toulouse, both together, and fixed our kind of time and when we were going to do it. When we attacked Toulouse, I'm afraid I went through and after having looked at the Prison Saint-Michel where André Malraux had been put in detention, I found that the prison gates had been opened and he'd escaped. Well, I went on with the fight against the Germans until it got to about 5 or 6 miles out of Toulouse, and then returned to Toulouse to find that the post office, the railways, the aerodromes, and the council for Toulouse had already been taken over by Ravanel, who'd put his communist troops in guard with a statement that I shouldn't, that we were not should not be admitted. Held by the communists.
Had you come to a previous agreement with Ravanel?
No, we'd come with an agreement to take